holding pen. "I believe these are some pretty good old boys," whispered Rollins. "Yeah, I believe they are, too. You see them old high-back center-fire rigs? Yeah. You reckon they think we're on the run down here? Ain't we?" Rollins didn't answer. After a while, he said, "I like hearing the cattle out there."
"Yeah, I do, too."
He didn't say much about Rocha, did he?
"Not a lot."
"You reckon that was his daughter?"
"I'd say it was."
"This is some country, ain't it?"
"Yeah, it is. Go to sleep."
"Bud?"
"Yeah?"
"This is how it was with the old Waddies, ain't it?"
"Yeah."
"How long you think you'd like to stay here?"
"About 100 years. Go to sleep."
Part 2. The Hacienda de Nuestra Señora de la Purísima Concepción was a ranch of 11,000 hectares situated along the edge of the Bolsón de Cuatro Ciénegas in the state of Coahuila. The western sections ran into the Sierra de Anteojo to elevations of 9,000 feet, but south and east the ranch occupied part of the broad barrial, or basin floor of the Bolsón, and was well watered with natural springs and clear streams, and dotted with marshes and shallow lakes, or lagunas. In the lakes and in the streams were species of fish not known elsewhere on earth, and birds and lizards and other forms of life as well, all long relict here, for the desert stretched away on every side. La Purísima was one of the very few ranches in that part of Mexico, retaining the full complement of 6 square leagues of land allotted by the colonizing legislation of 1824, and the owner, Don Hector Rocha y Villarreal, was one of the few hacendados who actually lived on the land he claimed, land which had been in his family for 170 years. He was 47 years old, and he was the first male heir in all that New World lineage to attain such an age. He ran upwards of 1,000 head of cattle on this land. He kept a house in Mexico City where his wife lived. He flew his own airplane. He loved horses. When he rode up to the gerente's house that morning, he was accompanied by 4 friends and by a retinue of mozos and 2 pack animals saddled with hardwood kayaks, one empty, the other carrying their noon provisions. They were attended by a pack of greyhound dogs, and the dogs were lean and silver in color, and they flowed among the legs of the horses, silent and fluid as running mercury, and the horses paid them no mind at all. The hacendado hallooed the house, and the gerente emerged in his shirt sleeves, and they spoke briefly, and the gerente nodded, and the hacendado spoke to his friends, and then all rode on. When they passed the bunkhouse and rode through the gate and turned into the road up country, some of the vaqueros were catching their horses in the trap and leading them out to saddle them for the day's work. John Grady and Rollins stood in the doorway drinking their coffee.
"Yonder he is," said Rollins.
John Grady nodded and slung the dregs of coffee out into the yard.
"Where the hell you reckon they're going?" said Rollins.
"I'd say they're going to run coyotes."
"They ain't got no guns."
"They got ropes."
Rollins looked at him.
"You shitting me?"
"I don't think so."
"Well, I'd damn sure like to see it."
"I would, too. You ready?"
They worked 2 days in the holding pens, branding and earmarking and castrating and dehorning and inoculating. On the 3rd day, the vaqueros brought a small herd of wild 3-year-old colts down from the mesa and penned them, and in the evening Rollins and John Grady walked over to look them over. They were bunched against the fence at the far side of the enclosure, and they were a mixed lot, roans and duns and bays and a few paints, and they were varied size and conformation. John Grady opened the gate, and he and Rollins walked in, and he closed it behind them. The horrified animals began to climb over one another and to break up and move along the fence in both directions.
"That's as spooky a bunch of horses as I ever saw," said Rollins.
"I don't know what we are."
"Don't know what we are?
I don't think so. I don't think they've ever seen a man afoot."
Rollins leaned and spat.
"You see anything there you'd have?"
"There's horses there."
"Where at?"
"Look at that dark bay right yonder."
"I'm looking."
"Look again."
"That horse won't weigh 800 pounds.
"Yeah, he will. Look at the hindquarters on him. He'd make a cow horse.
Look at that roan yonder." "That coon-footed son of a bitch."
"Well, yeah, he is a little. All right.
That other roan, that 3rd one to the right. The one with the white on him?"
Yeah. That's kindly a funny-looking horse to me.
No, you ain't. He's just colored peculiar.
You don't think that means nothing? He's got white feet.
That's a good horse. Look at his head. Look at the jaw on him. You gotta remember their tails are all growed out.
Yeah, maybe.
Rollins shook his head doubtfully.
You used to be awful particular about horses. Maybe you just ain't seen any in a long time.
John Grady nodded.
Yeah, he said. Well, I ain't forgot what they're supposed to look like.
The horses had grouped again at the far end of the pen and stood rolling their eyes and running their heads along each other's necks.
They got one thing going for them, said Rollins.
What's that?
They ain't had no Mexican to try and break them.
John Grady nodded. They studied the horses.
How many are there? Said John Grady.
Rollins looked him over.
15, 16?
I'll make it 16.
16, then.
You think you and me could break all of them in 4 days?
Depends on what you call broke.
Just halfway decent green broke horses. Say 6 saddles, double and stop and stand still to be saddled.
Rollins took his tobacco from his pocket and pushed back his hat.
What you got in mind? He said.
Breaking these horses.
Why 4 days?
You think we could do it?
They intend putting them in the rough string? My feeling is that any horse broke in 4 days is liable to come unbroken 4 more.
They're out of horses is how come them to be down here in the first place.
Rollins dabbed tobacco into the cupped paper.
You're telling me that what we're looking at here is our own string?
That's my guess.
We're looking at riding some cold-jawed son-of-a-bitch broke with one of them damn Mexican ring bits.
Well?
Rollins nodded.
What would you do, sideline them?
Yep.
You think there's that much rope on the place?
I don't know.
You'd be a wore-out son, Buck, I'll tell you that.
Think how good you'd sleep.
Rollins put the cigarette in his mouth and fished about for a match.
What else do you know that you ain't told me?
Armando says the old man's got horses all over that mountain.
How many horses?
Something like 400 head.
Rollins looked at him. He popped the match and lit the cigarette and flipped the match away.
What in hell for?
He'd started a breeding program before the war.
What kind of horses?
Media sangres.
What the hell is that?
Quarter horses, what we'd call them.
Yeah?
That roan yonder, said John Grady, is a flat-out billy horse if he does have bad feet.
Where do you reckon he come from?
Where they all come from, out of a horse called Jose Chiquito.
Little Joe?
Yeah.
The same horse?
The same horse.
Rollins smoked thoughtfully.
Both of them horses are sold in Mexico, said John Grady. 1 and 2.
What he's got up yonder is a big iguana of mares out of the old Traveler Ronda line of horses of Sheeran's.
What else? Said Rollins.
That's it. Let's go talk to the man.
They stood in the kitchen with their hats in their hands, and Gerente sat at the table and studied them.
Amancedores, he said.
Sí.
Ambos, he said.
Sí, ambos.
He leaned back. He drummed his fingers on the metal tabletop.
Hay 10 caballos en el potrero, said John Grady. Podemos amansarlos en 4 días.
They walked back across the yard to the bunkhouse to wash up for supper.
What did he say?
Said Rollins.
He said we were full of shit, but in a nice way.
Is that a flat-out no, do you reckon?
I don't think so. I don't think he can leave it at that.
They went to work on the green colts daybreak Sunday morning, dressing in the half-dark and clothes still wet from their washing them the night before, and walking out to the potrero before the stars were down, eating a cold tortilla wrapped around a scoop of cold beans and no coffee, and carrying their 40-foot maguey catch ropes coiled over their shoulders. They carried saddle blankets and a bosaleya, or riding hackamore with a metal noseband, and John Grady carried a pair of clean gunny sacks he'd slept on, and his Hamley saddle with the stirrups already shortened. They stood looking at the horses. The horses shifted and stood, gray shapes in the gray morning. Stacked on the ground outside the gate were coils of every kind of rope, cotton and manila and plaited rawhide and maguey and ixtle down to lengths of old woven hair macates and hand-plaited piecings of binder twine. Stacked against the fence were the 16 rope hackamores they'd spent the evening tying in the bunkhouse.
This bunch has done been culled once up on the mesa, ain't it?
I'd say so.
What do they want with the mares? They ride them down here.
Well, said Rollins, I can see why they're hard on a horse putting up with them bitches.
He shook his head and stuffed the last of the tortilla in his jaw and wiped his hands on his trousers and undid the wire and opened the gate. John Grady followed him in and stood the saddle on the ground and went back out and brought in a handful of ropes and hackamores and squatted to sort them out. Rollins stood building his loop.
I take it you don't give a particular damn what order they come in, he said.
You take it correctly, cousin.
You dead set on sacking these varmints out?
Yep.
My old daddy always said that the purpose of breaking a horse was to ride it. And if you got one to break, you just as well to saddle up and climb aboard and get on with it.
John Grady grinned. Is your old daddy a certified peeler?
I never heard him claim to be, but I damn sure seen him hang and rattle a time or two.
Well, you're fixing to see some more of it.
We gonna bust him twice?
What for?
I never saw one that completely believed it the first time or ever doubted it the second.
John Grady smiled.
I'll make him believe, he said. You'll see. I'm going to tell you right now, cousin, this is a heathenish bunch.
What is it Blair says? No such thing as a mean colt?
No such thing as a mean colt, said Rollins.
The horses were already moving. He took the first one that broke and rolled his loop and forefooted the colt, and it hit the ground with a tremendous thump. The other horses flared and bunched and looked back wildly. Before the colt could struggle up, John Grady had squatted on its neck and pulled its head up and to one side, and was holding the horse by the muzzle with the long, bony head pressed against his chest and the hot, sweet breath of it flooding up from the dark wells of its nostrils over his face and neck like news from another world. They did not smell like horses. They smelled like what they were, wild animals. He held the horse's face against his chest, and he could feel along his inner thighs the blood pumping through the arteries, and he could smell the fear, and he cupped his hand over the horse's eyes and stroked them, and he did not stop talking to the horse at all, speaking in a low, steady voice, and telling it all that he intended to do, and cupping the animal's eyes and stroking the terror out. Rollins took one of the lengths of side rope from around his neck where he'd hung them and made a slip noose and hitched it round the pastern of the hind leg and drew the leg up and half-hitched it to the horse's forelegs. He freed the catch rope and pitched it away and took the hackamore and they fitted it over the horse's muzzle and ears, and John Grady ran his thumb in the animal's mouth and Rollins fitted the mouth rope and then slip noosed a second side rope to the other rear leg. Then he tied both side ropes to the hackamore.
You all set?
He said.
All set.
He let go the horse's head and rose and stepped away. The horse struggled up and turned and shot out one hind foot and snatched itself around in a half circle and fell over. It got up and kicked again and fell again. When it got up the third time, it stood kicking and snatching its head about in a little dance. It stood. It walked away and stood again. Then it shot out a hind leg and fell again. It lay there for a while, thinking things over, and when it got up, it stood for a minute, and then it hopped up and down three times, and then it just stood, glaring at them. Rollins had got his catch rope and was building his loop again. The other horses watched with great interest from the far side of the potrero.
These sunbucks are as crazy as a shithouse rat, he said.
You pick out the one you think is craziest, said John Grady, and I'll give you a finished horse this time Sunday week.
Finished for who?
To your satisfaction.
Bullshit, said Rollins.
By the time they had three of the horses sidelined in the trap, blowing and glaring about, there were several vaqueros at the gate, drinking coffee in a leisurely fashion and watching the proceedings. By mid-morning, eight of the horses stood tied, and the other eight were wilder than deer, scattering along the fence and bunching and running in a rising sea of dust as the day warmed, coming to reckon slowly with the remorselessness of this rendering of their fluid and collective selves into that condition of separate and helpless paralysis which seemed to be among them like a creeping plague. The entire complement of vaqueros had come from the bunkhouse to watch, and by noon all 16 of the Misteños were standing about in the potrero, side-hobbled to their own hackamores, and faced about in every direction, and all communion among them broken. They looked like animals trussed up by children for fun, and they stood waiting for they knew not what, with the voice of the breaker still running in their brains like the voice of some god come to inhabit them. When they went down to the bunkhouse for dinner, the vaqueros seemed to treat them with a certain deference, but whether it was the deference accorded the accomplished or that accorded to mental defectives, they were unsure. No one asked them their opinion of the horses or queried them as to their method. When they went back up to the trap in the afternoon, there were some 20 people standing about looking at the horses, women, children, young girls, and men, and all waiting for them to return.
"Where the hell did they come from?" said Rollins.
"I don't know."
"Word gets around when the circus come to town, don't it?"
They passed, nodding through the crowd, and entered the trap and fastened the gate.
"You picked one out?" said John Grady.
"Yep. For pure crazy, I nominate that bucket-headed son of a bitch standing right yonder."
"The Gruyot?"
"Gruyot looking.
The man's a judge of horseflesh."
"He's a judge of craziness."
He watched while John Grady walked up to the animal and tied a 12-foot length of rope to the hackamore. Then he led it through the gate, out of the potrero, and into the corral where the horses would be ridden. Rollins thought the horse would shy or try to rear, but it didn't. He got the sack and hobble ropes and came up, and while John Grady talked to the horse, he hobbled the front legs together and then took the macate rope and handed John Grady the sack, and he held the horse while for the next quarter hour John Grady floated the sack over the animal and under it and rubbed its head with the sack and passed it across the horse's face and ran it up and down in between the animal's legs, talking to the horse the while and rubbing against it and leaning against it. Then he got the saddle.
"What good do you think it does to waller all over a horse that away?" said Rollins.
"I don't know," said John Grady. "I ain't a horse."
He lifted the blanket and placed it on the animal's back and smoothed it and stood, stroking the animal and talking to it, and then he bent and picked up the saddle and lifted it with the cinches strapped up and the off-stirrup hung over the horn and sat it on the horse's back and rocked it into place. The horse never moved. He bent and reached under and pulled up the strap and cinched it. The horse's ears went back and he talked to it, and then pulled up the cinch again, and he leaned against the horse and talked to it just as if it were neither crazy nor lethal. Rollins looked toward the corral gate. There were 50 or more people watching. Folk were picnicking on the ground. Fathers held up babies. John Grady lifted off the stirrup from the saddle horn and let it drop. Then he hauled up the cinch strap again and buckled it.
"All right," he said.
"Hold him," said Rollins.
He held the macate while Rollins undid the side ropes from the hackamore and knelt and tied them to the front hobbles. Then they slipped the hackamore off the horse's head, and John Grady raised the bosalea and gently fitted it over the horse's nose and fitted the mouth rope and headstall. He gathered the reins and looped them over the horse's head and nodded, and Rollins knelt and undid the hobbles and pulled the slip nooses until the side rope loops fell to the ground at the horse's rear hooves. Then he stepped away. John Grady put one foot in the stirrup and pressed himself flat against the horse's shoulder, talking to it, and then swung up into the saddle. The horse stood stock still. It shot out one hind foot to test the air and stood again, and then it threw itself sideways and twisted and kicked and stood snorting. John Grady touched it up in the ribs with his boot heels, and it stepped forward. He reined it, and it turned. Rollins spat in disgust. John Grady turned the horse again and came back by.
"What the hell kind of a bronc is that?" said Rollins. "You think that's what these people paid good money to see?"
By dark, he'd ridden 11 of the 16 horses, not all of them so tractable. Someone had built a fire on the ground outside the potrero, and there was something like 100 people gathered, some come from the pueblo of La Vega, 6 miles to the south, some from farther. He rode the last 5 horses by the light of that fire, the horses dancing, turning in the light, their red eyes flashing. When they were done, the horses stood in the potrero or stepped about, trailing their hackamore ropes over the ground, with such circumspection not to tread upon them, and snatched down their sore noses, that they moved with an air of great elegance and seemliness.
The wild and frantic band of mustangs that had circled the potrero that morning like marbles swirled in a jar could hardly be said to exist, and the animals whinnied to one another in the dark and answered back as if someone among their number were missing or something. When they walked down to the bunkhouse in the dark, the bonfire was still burning, and someone had brought a guitar and someone else a mouth harp. Three separate strangers offered them a drink from bottles of mezcal before they were clear of the crowd. The kitchen was empty, and they got their dinner from the stove and sat at the table. Rollins watched John Grady. He was chewing woodenly and half tottering on the bench.
"You ain't tired, are you, bud?" he said.
"No," said John Grady. "I was tired 5 hours ago." Rollins grinned.
"Don't drink no more of that coffee. It'll keep you awake."
When they walked out in the morning at daybreak, the fire was still smoldering, and there were four or five men lying asleep on the ground, some with blankets and some without. Every horse in the potrero watched them come through the gate.
"You remember how they come?" said Rollins.
"Yeah, I remember 'em. I know you remember your buddy yonder."
"Yeah, I know, the son of a bitch."
When he walked up to the horse with the sack, it turned and went trotting. He walked it down against the fence and picked up the rope and pulled it around, and it stood quivering. And he walked up to it and began to talk to it and then to stroke it with the sack. Rollins went to fetch the blankets and the saddle and the bosalea. By 10 that night, he'd ridden the entire remuda of 16 horses, and Rollins had ridden them a second time each. They rode them again Tuesday, and on Wednesday morning at daybreak, with the first horse saddled and the sun not up, John Grady rode toward the gate.
"Open her up," he said. "Let me saddle a catch horse."
"We ain't got time."
"If that son of a bitch sets your ass out in the stickers, you'll have time."
"I guess I better stay in the saddle then."
"Let me saddle up one of these good horses."
"All right." He rode out of the trap, leading Rollins' horse, and waited while Rollins shut the gate and mounted up beside him. The green horses stepped and sidled nervously.
"This is kindly the blind leading the blind, ain't it?"
Rollins nodded.
"It's sort of like old T-Bone Watts when he worked for Daddy. They all fussed about him having bad breath. He told him it was better than no breath at all."
John Grady grinned and booted the horse forward into a trot, and they set out up the road. Mid-afternoon, he'd ridden all the horses again, and while Rollins worked with them in the trap, he rode the little Grullo of Rollins' choice up into the country. 2 miles above the ranch, where the road ran by sedge and willow and wild plum along the edge of the laguna, she rode past him on the black horse. He heard the horse behind him and would have turned to look, but that he heard it change gates. He didn't look at her until the Arabian was alongside his horse, stepping with its neck arched and one eye on the Mesteño, not with wariness, but some faint equine disgust. She passed 5 feet away and turned her fine-boned face and looked full at him. She had blue eyes, and she nodded, or perhaps she only lowered her head slightly to better see what sort of horse he rode. Just the slightest tilt of the broad black hat set level on her head, the slightest lifting of the long black hair. She passed. And the horse changed gates again, and she sat the horse more than well, riding erect with her broad shoulders and trotting the horse up the road. The Mesteño had stopped and sulled in the road with its 4 feet spread, and he sat looking after her. He'd half meant to speak, but those eyes had altered the world forever in the space of a heartbeat. She disappeared beyond the lakeside willows. A flock of small birds rose up and passed back over him with thin calls. That evening, when Antonio and the gerente came up to the trap to inspect the horses, he was teaching the Grullo to back with Rollins in the saddle. They watched, the gerente picking his teeth. Antonio rode the 2 horses that were standing saddled, sawing them back and forth in the corral and pulling them up short. He dismounted and nodded, and he and the gerente looked over the horses in the other wing of the corral, and then they left. Rollins and John Grady looked at each other. They unsaddled the horses and turned them in with the remuda, and walked back down to the house carrying their saddles and gear and washed up for supper. The vaqueros were at the table, and they got their plates and helped themselves at the stove, and got their coffee and came to the table,
and swung a leg over and sat down. There was a clay dish of tortillas in the center of the table with a towel over it, and when John Grady pointed and asked that it be passed, there came hands from both sides of the table to take up the dish and hand it down in this manner like a ceremonial bowl. 3 days later, they were in the mountains. The caporal had sent a mozo with them to cook and see to the horses, and he'd sent 3 young vaqueros not much older than they. The mozo was an old man with a bad leg named Luis, who had fought at Torreon and San Pedro and later at Zacatecas, and the boys were boys from the country, 2 of them born on the hacienda. Only 1 of the 3 had ever been as far as Monterrey. They rode up into the mountains, trailing 3 horses apiece in their string, with pack horses to haul the grub and cook tent, and they hunted the wild horses in the upland forests, in the pine and madroño, and in the arroyos where they'd gone to hide, and they drove them, pounding over the high mesas, and penned them in the stone ravine fitted 10 years earlier with fence and gate, and there the horses milled and squealed and clambered at the rock slopes and turned upon one another biting and kicking while John Grady walked among them in the sweat and dust and bedlam with his rope as if they were no more than some evil dream of horse. They camped at night on the high headlands where their wind-tattered fire sawed about in the darkness, and Luis told them tales of the country and the people who lived in it and the people who died and how they died. He'd loved horses all his life, and he and his father and 2 brothers had fought in the cavalry, and his father and his brothers had died in the cavalry, but they'd all despised Victoriano Huerta above all other men, and the deeds of Huerta above all other visited evils. He said that compared to Huerta, Judas was himself but another Christ, and one of the young vaqueros looked away, and another blessed himself. He said that war had destroyed the country, and that men believe the cure for war is war, as the curandero prescribes the serpent's flesh for its bite. He spoke of his campaigns in the deserts of Mexico, and he told them of horses killed under him, and he said that the souls of horses mirror the souls of men more closely than men suppose, and that horses also love war. Men say they only learn this, but he said that no creature can learn that which his heart has no shape to hold. His own father said that no man who has not gone to war horseback can ever truly understand the horse, and he said that he supposed he wished that this were not so, but that it was so. Lastly, he said that he had seen the souls of horses, and that it was a terrible thing to see. He said that it could be seen under certain circumstances attending the death of a horse, because the horse shares a common soul, and its separate life only forms it out of all horses and makes it mortal. He said that if a person understood the soul of the horse, then he would understand all horses that ever were. They sat smoking, watching the deepest embers of the fire where the red coals cracked and broke. ¿Y de los hombres? Said John Grady. The old man shaped his mouth how to answer. Finally he said that among men there was no such communion as among horses, and the notion that men can be understood at all was probably an illusion. Rawlins asked him in his bad Spanish if there was a heaven for horses, but he shook his head and said that a horse had no need of heaven. Finally, John Grady asked him if it were not true that should all horses vanish from the face of the earth, the soul of the horse would not also perish, for there would be nothing out of which to replenish it. But the old man only said that it was pointless to speak of there being no horses in the world, for God would not permit such a thing. They drove the mares down through the draws and arroyos out of the mountains, and across the watered grasslands of the Bolson and Pendon. They were at this work for 3 weeks, until by the end of April they had over 80 mares in the trap, most of them halter-broke, some already sorted out for saddle horses. By then the roundup was underway, and droves of cattle were moving daily down out of the open country onto the ranch pastures. And although some of the vaqueros had no more than 2 or 3 horses to their string, the new horses stayed in the trap. On the second morning of May, the red Cessna plane came in from the south, and circled the ranch, and banked and dropped and glided from sight beyond the trees. An hour later, John Grady was standing in the ranch house kitchen with his hat in his hands. A woman was washing dishes at the sink, and a man was sitting at the table reading a newspaper. The woman wiped her hands on her apron and went off into another part of the house, and in a few minutes she returned.
Un ratito, she said.
John Grady nodded.
Gracias, he said.
The man rose and folded the newspaper and crossed the kitchen, and came back with a wooden rack of butcher and boning knives, together with an oil stone, and set them out on the paper. At the same moment, Don Hector appeared in the doorway and stood looking at John Grady. He was a spare man, with broad shoulders and graying hair, and he was tall, in the manner of norteños, and light of skin. He entered the kitchen and introduced himself, and John Grady shifted his hat to his left hand, and they shook hands.
"Maria," said the hacendado, "café, por favor."
He held out his hand, palm upward, toward the doorway, and John Grady crossed the kitchen and entered the hall. The house was cool and quiet, and smelled of wax and flowers. A tall case clock stood in the hallway to the left. The brass weights stirred behind the casement doors. The pendulum slowly swept. He turned to look back, and the hacendado smiled and extended his hand toward the dining room doorway.
Pásale, he said.
They sat at a long table of English walnut. The walls of the room were covered with blue damask and hung with portraits of men and horses. At the end of the room was a walnut sideboard with some chafing dishes and decanters set out upon it, and along the windowsill outside, taking the sun, were four cats. Don Hector reached behind him and took a china ashtray from the sideboard and placed it before them and took from his shirt pocket a small tin box of English cigarettes and opened them and offered them to John Grady, and John Grady took one.
Gracias, he said.
The hacendado placed the tin on the table between them and took a silver lighter from his pocket and lit the boy's cigarette and then his own.
Gracias.
The man blew a thin stream of smoke slowly down table and smiled.
Bueno, he said. We can speak English.
Como le convenga, said John Grady.
Armando tells me that you understand horses.
I've been around them some.
The hacendado smoked thoughtfully. He seemed to be waiting for more to be said. The man who'd been sitting in the kitchen reading the paper entered the room with a silver tray carrying a coffee service with cups and cream pitcher and a sugar bowl, together with a plate of bizcochos. He set the tray on the table and stood a moment, and the hacendado thanked him and he went out again. Don Hector set out the cups himself and poured the coffee and nodded at the tray.
Please help yourself, he said.
Thank you, I just take it black.
You are from Texas?
Yes, sir.
The hacendado nodded again. He sipped his coffee. He was seated sideways to the table with his legs crossed. He flexed his foot in the chocolate-colored veal boot and turned and looked at John Grady and smiled.
Why are you here? He said.
John Grady looked at him. He looked down the table where the shadows of the sunning cats sat in a row like cut-out cats, all leaning slightly aslant. He looked at the hacendado again.
I just wanted to see the country, I reckon. Or we did.
May I ask, how old are you?
16.
The hacendado raised his eyebrows.
16, he said.
Yes, sir.
The hacendado smiled again.
When I was 16, I told people I was 18.
John Grady sipped his coffee.
Your friend is 16 also?
17.
But you are the leader.
We don't have no leaders, we're just buddies.
Of course.
He nudged the plate forward.
Please, he said, help yourself.
Thank you, I just got up from the breakfast table.
The hacendado tipped the ash from his cigarette into the china ashtray and sat back again.
What is your opinion of the mares, he said.
There are some good mares in that bunch.
Yes.
Do you know a horse called Three Bars?
That's a thoroughbred horse.
You know the horse?
I know he run in the Brazilian Grand Prix. I think he come out of Kentucky, but he's owned by a man named Vale out of Douglas, Arizona.
Yes. The horse was foaled at Monterey Farm in Paris, Kentucky. The stallion I have bought is a half-brother out of the same mare.
Yes, sir. Where is he at?
He is en route.
He's where?
En route, from Mexico.
The hacendado smiled. He has been standing at stud.
You intend to raise racehorses?
No. I intend to raise quarter horses.
To use here on the ranch?
Yes.
You aim to breed this stallion to your mares?
Yes. What is your opinion?
I don't have an opinion. I've known a few breeders and some with a world of experience, but I've noticed they were all pretty short on opinions. I do know there's been some good cow horses sired out of thoroughbreds.
Yes. How much importance do you give to the mare?
Same as the sire, in my opinion.
Most breeders place more confidence in the horse.
Yes, sir, they do.
The hacendado smiled. I happen to agree with you.
John Grady leaned and tipped the ash from his cigarette.
You don't have to agree with me.
No, nor do you with me.
Yes, sir.
Tell me about the horses up on the mesa.
There may be a few of them good mares still up there, but not many. The rest I'd pretty much call scrubs. Even some of them might make a half-decent cow horse. Just all-around using kind of a horse. Spanish ponies, what we used to call them. Chihuahua horses. Old barb stock. They're small and they're a little on the light side. They don't have the hindquarters you'd want in a cutting horse, but you can rope off of them.
He stopped.
He looked at the hat in his lap and ran his fingers along the crease and looked up.
I ain't telling you nothing you don't know.
The hacendado took up the coffee pitcher and poured their cups.
Do you know what a criollo is?
Yes, sir, that's an Argentine horse.
Do you know who Sam Jones was?
I do if you're talking about a horse.
Crawford Sykes.
That's another Uncle Billy Anson's horses. I heard about that horse all my life.
My father bought horses from Mr. Anson.
Uncle Billy and my granddaddy were friends. They were born within 3 days of each other. He was the seventh son of the Earl of Litchfield. His wife was an actress on the stage.
You are from Cristoval?
San Angelo, or just outside of San Angelo.
The hacendado studied him. Do you know a book called The Horse of America by Wallace?
Yes, sir. I've read it front to back.
The hacendado leaned back in his chair. One of the cats rose and stretched. You rode here from Texas?
Yes, sir.
You and your friend?
Yes, sir.
Just the two of you?
John Grady looked at the table. The paper cat stepped thin and slant among the shapes of cats thereon. He looked up again.
Yes, sir, he said. Just me and him.
The hacendado nodded and stubbed out his cigarette and pushed back his chair.
Come, he said. I will show you some horses.
They sat opposite on their bunks with their elbows on their knees, leaning forward and looking down at their folded hands. After a while, Rollins spoke. He didn't look up.
It's an opportunity for you. Ain't no reason for you to turn it down that I can see.
If you don't want me to, I won't. I'll stick right here.
It ain't like you was going off someplace.
We'll still be working together, bringing in horses and all.
Rollins nodded. John Grady watched him.
You just say the word and I'll tell him no.
Ain't no reason to do that, said Rollins. It's an opportunity for you.
In the morning they ate breakfast, and Rollins went out to work the pens. When he came in at noon, John Grady's tick was rolled up at the head of his bunk and his gear was gone. Rollins went on to the back to wash up for dinner. The barn was built on the English style, and it was sheathed with milled 1x4s and painted white, and it had a cupola and a weather vane on top of the cupola. His room was at the far end next to the saddle room. Across the bay was another cubicle where there lived an old groom who'd worked for Rocha's father. When John Grady led his horse through the barn, the old man came out and stood and looked at the horse. Then he looked at its feet. Then he looked at John Grady. Then he turned and went back into his room and shut the door. In the afternoon, while he was working one of the new mares in the corral outside the barn, the old man came out and watched him. John Grady said him a good afternoon, and the old man nodded and said one back. He watched the mare. He said she was stocky. He said, rechoncha, and John Grady didn't know what it meant, and he asked the old man, and the old man made a barrel shape with his arms, and John Grady thought he meant that she was pregnant, and he said, no, she wasn't, and the old man shrugged and went back in. When he took the mare back to the barn, the old man was pulling the cinch strap on the black Arabian. The girl stood with her back to him. When the shadow of the mare darkened the bay door, she turned and looked. Buenas tardes, he said. Buenas tardes, she said. She reached and slid her fingers under the strap to check it. He stood at the bay door. She raised up and passed the reins over the horse's head and put her foot in the stirrup and stood up into the saddle and turned the horse and rode down the bay and out the door. That night, as he lay in his cot, he could hear music from the house. And as he was drifting to sleep, his thoughts were of horses and of the open country and of horses. Horses still wild on the mesa who'd never seen a man afoot and who knew nothing of him or his life, yet in whose souls he would come to reside forever. They went up into the mountains a week later with the mozo and two of the vaqueros, and after the vaqueros had turned in their blankets, he and Rawlins sat by the fire on the rim of the mesa drinking coffee. Rawlins took out his tobacco, and John Grady took out cigarettes and shook the pack at him. Rawlins put his tobacco back. "Where'd you get the ready rolls?" "In La Vega," he nodded. He took a brand from the fire and lit the cigarette, and John Grady leaned and lit his own. "You say she goes to school in Mexico City?"
"Yeah."
"How old is she?"
17.
Rawlins nodded. "What kind of school is it she goes to?"
"I don't know. It's some kind of a prep school or something."
"Fancy sort of school."
"Yeah, fancy sort of school."
Rawlins smoked. "Well," he said, "she's a fancy sort of girl."
"No, she ain't."
Rawlins was leaning against his propped saddle, sitting with his legs crossed sideways onto the fire. The sole of his right boot had come loose, and he'd fastened it back with hog rings stapled through the welt. He looked at the cigarette.
"Well," he said, "I've told you before, but I don't reckon you'll listen now any more than you done then."
"Yeah, I know."
"I just figure you must enjoy crying yourself to sleep at night."
John Grady didn't answer.
"This one, of course, she probably dates guys got their own airplanes, let alone cars."
"You're probably right."
"I'm glad to hear you say it."
"Don't help nothing, though, does it?" Rawlins sucked on the cigarette. They sat for a long time. Finally, he pitched the stub of the cigarette into the fire.
"I'm going to bed," he said.
"Yeah," said John Grady, "I guess that's a good idea." They spread their sugans, and he pulled off his boots and stood them beside him and stretched out in his blankets. The fire had burned to coals, and he lay looking up at the stars in their places, and the hot belt of matter that ran the cord of the dark vault overhead. And he put his hands on the ground at either side of him and pressed them against the earth, and in that coldly burning canopy of black he slowly turned dead center to the world, all of it taut and trembling and moving, enormous and alive under his hands.
"What's her name?" said Rawlins in the darkness.
"Alejandra. Her name is Alejandra." Sunday afternoon they rode into the town of La Vega on horses they'd been working out of the new string. They'd had their hair cut with sheep shears by an esquilador at the ranch, and the backs of their necks above their collars were as white as scars, and they wore their hats cocked forward on their heads, and they looked from side to side as they jogged along, as if to challenge the countryside or anything it might hold. They raced the animals on the road at a 50-cent bet, and John Grady won, and they swapped horses, and he won on Rollins' horse. They rode the horses at a gallop, and they rode them at a trot, and the horses were hot and lathered and squatted and stamped in the road, and the campesinos afoot in the road with baskets of garden stuff or pails covered with cheesecloth would press to the edge of the road or climb through the roadside brush and cactus to watch wide-eyed the young horsemen on their horses passing, and the horses mouthing froth and champing, and the riders calling to one another in their alien tongue and passing in a muted fury that seemed scarcely to be contained in the space allotted them, and yet leaving all unchanged where they had been. Dust, sunlight, a singing bird. In the tienda, the topmost shirts folded upon the shelves when shaken out retained a square of paler color where dust had settled on the cloth, or sun had faded it, or both. They sorted through the stacks to find one with sleeves long enough for Rollins. The woman holding out the sleeve along the outstretched length of his arm, the pins caught in her mouth like a seamstress where she meant to refold, repin the shirt, shaking her head doubtfully. They carried stiff new canvas pants to the rear of the store and tried them on in a bedroom that had three beds in it, in a cold concrete floor that had once been painted green. They sat on one of the beds and counted their money. "How much are these breeches if they're 15 pesos? "Just remember the 2 pesos is 2 bits.
"You remember it. How much are they?"
$1.87.
"Hell," said Rollins. "We're in good shape. We get paid in 5 days.
They bought socks and underwear, and they piled everything on the counter while the woman totted up the figures. Then she wrapped the new clothes in 2 separate parcels and tied them with string. "What have you got left?" said John Grady.
$4 and something.
"Get a pair of boots."
"I lack some, having enough."
"I'll let you have the difference."
"You sure?"
"Yeah."
"We got to have some operating capital for this evening."
"We'll still have a couple of dollars. Go on."
"What if you want to buy that sweet thing a soda pop?"
"It'll set me back about 4 cents. Go on." Rollins handled the boots dubiously. He stood one against the sole of his own raised boot.
"These things are awful small.
Try these."
"Black?"
"Sure, why not?" Rollins pulled on the new boots and walked up and down the floor. The woman nodded approvingly. "What do you think?" said John Grady.
"They're all right. These underslung heels take some getting used to."
"Let's see you dance."
"Do what?"
"Dance." Rollins looked at the woman and he looked at John Grady.
"Shit," he said. "You're looking at a dancing fool."
"Well, hit it there a few steps." Rollins executed a nimble 9-step stomp on the old board floor and stood grinning in the dust he'd raised.
"Qué guapo," said the woman.
John Grady grinned and reached in his pocket for his money.
"We forgot to get gloves," said Rollins.
"Gloves?"
"Gloves. We get done sporting, we're going to have to go back to work."
"You got a point."
"Them old hot Maggie ropes have eat my hands about up."
John Grady looked at his own hands. He asked the woman where the gloves were, and they bought a pair apiece. They stood at the counter while she wrapped them. Rollins was looking down at his boots.
"The old man's got some good silk manila ropes in the barn," said John Grady. "I'll slip one out to you quick as I get a chance."
"Black boots," said Rollins.
"Ain't that the shits? I always wanted to be a bad man."
Although the night was cool, the double doors of the Grange stood open, and the man selling the tickets was seated in a chair on a raised wooden platform just within the doors, so that he must lean down to each in a gesture akin to benevolence and take their coins and hand them down their tickets or pass upon the ticket stubs of those who were only returning from outside. The old adobe hall was buttressed along its outer walls with piers, not all of which had been a part of its design, and there were no windows, and the walls were swagged and cracked. A string of electric bulbs ran the length of the hall at either side, and the bulbs were covered with paper bags that had been painted, and the brush strokes showed through in the light, and the reds and greens and blues were all muted and much of a piece. The floor was swept, but there were pockets of seeds underfoot, and drifts of straw, and at the far end of the hall a small orchestra labored on a stage of grain pallets under a bandshell rigged from sheeting. Along the foot of the stage were lights set in fruit cans among colored crepe that smoldered throughout the night. The mouths of the cans were lensed with tinted cellophane, and they cast upon the sheeting a shadow play in the lights and smoke of antic demon players, and a pair of goat hawks arced, chittering through the partial darkness overhead. John Grady and Rawlins and a boy named Roberto from the ranch stood just beyond the reach of light at the door among the cars and wagons, and passed among themselves a pint medicine bottle of mezcal. Roberto held the bottle to the light.
"A las chicas," he said.
He drank and handed off the bottle. They drank. They poured salt from a paper onto their wrists and licked it off, and Roberto pushed the cob stopper into the neck of the bottle and hid the bottle behind the tire of a parked truck, and they passed around a pack of chewing gum.
"Listos?"
he said.
"Listos."
She was dancing with a tall boy from the San Pablo ranch, and she wore a blue dress, and her mouth was red. He and Rawlins and Roberto stood with other youths along the wall and watched the dancers, and watched beyond the dancers the young girls at the far side of the hall. He moved along past the groups. The air smelled of straw and sweat and a rich spice of colognes. Under the bandshell, the accordion player struggled with his instrument and slammed his boot on the boards and counter time, and stepped back, and the trumpet player came forward. Her eyes above the shoulder of her partner swept across him where he stood, her black hair done up in a blue ribbon, and the nape of her neck pale as porcelain. When she turned again, she smiled. He'd never touched her, and her hand was small, and her waist so slight. And she looked at him with great forthrightness, and smiled, and put her face against his shoulder. They turned under the lights. A long trumpet note guided the dancers on their separate and collective paths. Moths circled the paper lights aloft, and the goat hawks passed down the wires and flared and arced upward into the darkness again. She spoke in an English learned largely from schoolbooks, and he tested each phrase for the meanings he wished to hear, repeating them silently to himself, and then questioning them anew. She said that she was glad that he'd come.
"I told you I would."
"Yes." They turned, the trumpet rapped.
"Did you not think I would?"
She tossed her head back and looked at him, smiling, her eyes aglint.
"Al contrario," she said. "I knew you would come."
At the band's intermission, they made their way to the refreshment stand, and he bought two lemonades and paper cones, and they went out and walked in the night air. They walked along the road, and there were other couples in the road, and they passed and wished them a good evening. The air was cool, and it smelled of earth and perfume and horses. She took his arm, and she laughed and called him a mojado reverso, so rare a creature and one to be treasured. He told her about his life, how his grandfather was dead and the ranch sold. They sat on a low concrete water trough, and with her shoes in her lap and her naked feet crossed in the dust, she drew patterns in the dark water with her finger. She'd been away at school for 3 years. Her mother lived in Mexico, and she went to the house on Sundays for dinners, and sometimes she and her mother would dine alone in the city and go to the theater or the ballet. Her mother thought that life on the hacienda was lonely, and yet living in the city she seemed to have few friends. "She becomes angry with me, because I always want to come here. She says that I prefer my father to her."
"Do you?"
She nodded. "Yes, but that is not why I come. Anyway, she says I will change my mind."
"About coming here?"
"About everything." She looked at him and smiled. "Shall we go in?" He looked toward the lights. The music had started. She stood and bent with one hand on his shoulder and slipped on her shoes. "I will introduce you to my friends. I will introduce you to Lucia. She's very pretty, you will see."
"I bet she ain't as pretty as you."
"Oh, my, you must be careful what you say.
Besides, it is not true. She is prettier. He rode back alone with the smell of her perfume on his shirt. The horses were still tied and standing at the edge of the barn, but he could not find Rollins or Roberto. When he untied his horse, the other two tossed their heads and whinnied softly to go. Cars were starting up in the yard, and groups of people were moving along the road, and he untracted the greenbroke horse out from the lights and into the road before mounting up. A mile from the town, a car passed full of young men, and they were going fast, and he reined the horse to the side of the road, and the horse skittered and danced in the glare of the headlights, and as they passed, they called out at him, and someone threw an empty beer can. The horse reared and pitched and kicked out, and he held it under him and talked to it as if nothing at all had happened. And after a while they went on again. The boil of dust the car had left lay before them down the narrow straight as far as he could see, roiling slowly in the starlight like something enormous uncoiling out of the earth. He thought the horse had handled itself well, and as he rode he told it so. The Hacendado had bought the horse through an agent, sight unseen, at the spring sales in Lexington, and he'd sent Armando's brother Antonio to get the animal and bring it back. Antonio left the ranch in a 1941 International flatbed truck towing a homemade sheet metal trailer, and he was gone 2 months. He carried with him letters in both English and Spanish, signed by Don Hector, stating his business, and he carried a brown bank envelope tied with a string in which was a great deal of money in both dollars and pesos together with sight drafts on banks in Houston and Memphis. He spoke no English, and he could neither read nor write. When he got back, the envelope was gone together with the Spanish letter, but he had the English letter, and it was separated into three parts along the lines of its folding, and it was dog-eared and coffee-stained and stained with other stains, some of which may have been blood. He'd been in jail once in Kentucky, once in Tennessee, and 3 times in Texas. When he pulled into the yard, he got out and walked stiffly to the house and knocked at the kitchen door. Maria let him in, and he stood with his hat in his hand while she went for the Hacendado. When the Hacendado entered the kitchen, they shook hands gravely, and the Hacendado asked after his health, and he said that it was excellent, and handed him the pieces of the letter, together with a sheaf of bills and receipts from cafes and gas stations and feed stores and jails, and he handed him the money he had left, including the change in his pockets, and he handed him the keys to the truck, and lastly he handed him the factura from the Mexican aduana at Piedras Negras, together with a long manila envelope tied with a blue ribbon that contained the papers on the horse and the bill of sale. Don Hector piled the money and the receipts and the papers on the sideboard and put the keys in his pocket. He asked if the truck had proved satisfactory. Sí, said Antonio. Es una troca muy fuerte. Bueno, said the Hacendado. ¿Y el caballo? Está un poco cansado de su viaje, pero es muy bonito. So he was. He was a deep chestnut in color and stood 16 hands high and weighed about 1,400 pounds, and he was well-muscled and heavily boned for his breed. When they brought him back from the Distrito Federal in the same trailer in the 3rd week of May, and John Grady and Señor Rocha walked out to the barn to look at him, John Grady simply pushed open the door to the stall and entered and walked up to the horse and leaned against it, and began to rub it and talk to it softly in Spanish. The Hacendado offered no advice about the horse at all. John Grady walked all around it, talking to it. He lifted up one front hoof and examined it. "Have you ridden him?" he said. "But of course." "I'd like to ride him, con su permiso." The Hacendado nodded. "Yes," he said, "of course." He came out of the stall and shut the door, and they stood looking at the stallion. "Me gusta?" said the Hacendado. John Grady nodded. "That's a hell of a horse," he said. In the days to follow, the Hacendado would come up to the corral where they'd shaped the manada, and he and John Grady would walk among the mares, and John Grady would argue their points, and the Hacendado would muse and walk away a fixed distance and stand looking back and nod and muse again and walk off with his eyes to the ground to a fresh vantage point, and then look up to see the mare anew,
willing to see a new mare should one present itself. Where he could find no gifts of either stance or confirmation to warrant his young breeder's confidence, John Grady would likely defer to his judgment.